us to think this morning about this story that we know so well about the catch of the fish. I want us to think about different moments in the story. The moment when Jesus is preaching, teaching the little is the word of God. And so many people are so desperate to hear what he says that he has to take a boat off the shore so he can speak. I want us to think about that moment when Jesus says to some fishermen, why not go out and fish again, even though they've hardly caught anything the night before. I want us to think about that moment where they put their nets into the sea and suddenly they're filled with fish. I want us to think about that moment where Peter flings himself onto the deck of this almost sinking boat and says, get away from me, Jesus, for I am a sinful man. I want us to think about what the disciples thought about when Jesus said, do not fear, for I will make you fishers of men. And something must have very profoundly affected them because they took the boats into shore at that point. And when they got into shore, the disciples just simply put down their nets, left their boats behind, and went after him. I want us to think about those bits of the story and think, where does this story connect with you and what does it say to you about you and God and Jesus and the story of the gospel? Let me tell you a few other stories this morning. The first is the story of a photograph called Pale Blue Dot. Pale Blue Dot was taken on Valentine's Day in 1990. It was taken 6 million kilometres away from the Earth by the space probe Voyager 1. You will remember probably the story of Voyager 1. It was the first big space probe that went to Jupiter and took the most incredible pictures of Jupiter, which you can still see in the southern sky in the mornings at the moment, and showed the gas clouds and the red and the swirling red dot, and sights that we've never seen before. And then it went on to Saturn and showed the rings, and then kept on going past Uranus and Neptune out towards Pluto and what's called the Kuiper Belt at the edge of the galaxy, or the edge of the solar system. And at that point, the well-known American astronomer Carl Sagan started phoning up his pals in NASA and said, listen, could you not take a picture of the Earth? And all the people at NASA kept saying, well, what would be the point in that? The point is that we're wanting to see Jupiter, and we want to see Saturn and Neptune, but we're not, you know, that interested. We can see the Earth all any time we want. And he said, no, I'd like to take a picture of the Earth. He said, oh, no, we can't do that. We'll damage the instruments as we turn around to face the sun. And he said, oh, we can't do that because we've actually got a little bit fed up with Voyager 1 and it's a bit short-staffed at the moment and we don't have people to do the calculations to work out how to get the photo. And eventually an administrator got on the line to somebody and said, listen, Carl's giving us a hard time. Would you mind just getting this picture? So they turned the cameras around and from 6 million kilometres away, they took the photograph, which is called Pale Blue Dot. And what it is it's three bands of colour going across this darkened photograph, and you think the bands of colour must be rings, they're just the rays of light bouncing off the lens, it's lens flare. And people say, and here's the pale blue dot, and you think, what am I looking at? It's just dark with these bands. And then one of the bands on the right-hand side there is a tiny fleck. In fact, I thought it was a piece of duct on my computer screen when I first looked at it. It's that tiny. And that is planet Earth from 6 million kilometres away. This tiny little speck, smaller than dust on your screen. And Carl Sagan said of that pale blue dot, he said, we succeeded in taking that picture from deep space, and if you look at it, you see a dot that's here. That's home. That's us, that dot. On it, everyone you ever heard of, every human being who ever lived, who lived out their lives, the aggregate of all joys and sufferings and thousands of confident religions, ideologies and economic doctrines, every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilizations was on that pale blue dot. Every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every hopeful child, every corrupt politician, every superstar. To us, the earth is this vast, small stage in a cosmic arena. Think of the rivers of blood spilled by all those generals and emperors so that in glory and in triumph they become the momentary masters of a tiny fraction of that dot. Think of the endless cruelties visited by the inhabitants of one corner on the dot and scarcely distinguishable inhabitants of some other corner of the dot. How frequent their misunderstandings, posturings, imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged position in the universe, he said, challenged by this pale dot spot of light. And the Gospel says, Sagan is right apart from one detail. We remain privileged because God, who could see Earth from 6 million kilometres away, still went there. For him, it was not just a speck, but a place he loved. And this is the grandness of the mystery of the Gospel. That God, who is bigger than universe, moves to that tiny dot and loves and lives as human. And the miracle of this great condensation of God, this desire within God to express God's self, which is called the Word of God, that's the expression of God, takes place in Jesus. And Jesus stands on the shore of Galilee, the expression of God compacted into tiny human. And people sense the mystery and they crowd. Because something is going on here, deeply mysterious and deeply powerful. And Jesus stands back from the shore, and these irreligious fishermen are mending their nets, only casually interested. Now you need to know about the fishermen that the fishermen were, and I'm going to use a crude term that was sometimes used in Scotland, were the thickos. They were the stupid guys. You went to school, and in Old Testament times, the syllabus was simply the Old Testament, and you learnt off by heart the first 5 books of the Bible, the Torah, the books of Moses. And you would recite these day after day. And the very, very best, they got to stay on past the ages of 8 and 9. But the rest, the other guys, there'd be a conversation one day and they'd say, we're really, really sorry, Mr. and Mrs. Benjamin, but young Moshe isn't doing quite so well in Deuteronomy and we really think it might be fishing for him. And mum and dad would come home one day, heartbroken, the dreams of him being a rabbi, a wee clip round the ear from his dad, right, tomorrow, son, it's off to the sardines. But you know, these guys would have lived with the disappointment, and their classmates would have gone on, and they would have memorised the rest of the Old Testament. They'd memorised the Old Testament, I mean, it's huge. And the very, very best of them would get kept on, but most of them at that point would be sent away. And they'd kind of come trudging down to the fishing boat. So it's sardines for us boys. And Moshe would say to Zechariah, ha, you're not as smart as you think you are. And Zechariah's mum and dad would be giving him a clip around the ear and saying, oh, you're as thick as Moses, off you go and get some trout. So these are the guys who didn't make it. Because even the guys that stayed on and learnt the whole of the Old Testament, only the very, very best got to study under a rabbi. Only the very, very cleverest. most of you would have been doing fine. But, you know, only the very, very cleverest got to study with the rabbi. And only the smartest ever became a rabbi. And if you were lucky enough to get following a rabbi, then people really looked after you. So when the rabbi turns to these fishermen with their nets, the hard lads, the thickos, the stupid guys, who don't really get religion. These are guys who know how to fish and to swear and to drink and to clip their own sons round the ear. Although they're 16 or 17 most of them, so they probably don't have kids at this stage. He turns to them and says, "Listen boys, we'll go out fishing." I was thinking, woof, a rabbi wants to come in my boat. So they take the rabbi out, and he says, "Drop your nets," and they say, "This guy's daft. He doesn't know there's no fish out here. And if you're not going to catch them at night, there's no chance of catching them during the day when the water's hot." But just to indulge them, they drop the nets in. And the nets fill up. And in Peter, something comes over him that he realizes the miracle of what's going on here, that something is happening in the depths of this lake. He doesn't know what, whether somehow God is sending some current that is whipping up all the fish and sending them into this net, or maybe he's got into their brains, or maybe, I don't know, he's dangling smoky bacon down there. I don't know what God is doing. But God's doing something there. God, who could be way out in space, is down in this lake. And he's getting the fish. I like to think, by the way, there's a vegan interpretation of this parable that he's anesthetizing the fish or something like that. They're not going to suffer here. We don't need to worry about that. And they're going to go off to fish heaven, so we don't need to worry about them. But anyway, God's doing something. And Peter realizes this miracle, that God, who's massive, is doing something down in this lake. And he wants nothing to do with it, because this is scary. He would prefer to be in the world of his stupidity and his failure and his not having made it. Somehow we prefer the familiarity of our failure to the potential strangeness of our success. And he falls down in this sodden boat, which is half sinking. And he says, "Away from me, I am a sinful man. You want nothing to do with the likes of me. You don't know the things I think about. You don't know the bitternesses that I foster. You don't know how I sometimes speak to my mother or to my wife. You don't know the half of the secrets that I carry around with me. Away from me." And Jesus says, "Do not fear. Everything you're scared of, your failure, the narratives that you live with about your second-rateness are a piece of nonsense. Because the God who's out beyond Jupiter is here at this moment, and he's saying to Peter, 'I want you.'" And these guys take the boat in and they put down their nets, put down the chance they have of making a wage, put down the expectations that everybody thinks they're going to carry on the family business, take down the security of the thing that they know and thought they were good at, ish, and they go after him. What kind of God does that? What kind of God goes to these teenagers who think they are doomed to the familiarity of repeating the pattern of generations, and says, "I'm going to make you fishers of men"? Think of the scandal of the God who does that. Yesterday I heard a story from a guy called Alan McWilliam, who's a minister in Glasgow. Alan is someone who is obsessed with the nature that church should not be particularly churchy. He's one of these guys who wears shorts, even though he's in his 50s. Sorry if you do that. Alan's odd ideas. He was once part of a ministry, persuaded the Church of Scotland to free him up 2 days a week, I think it was, to minister to the members of the Tartan Army. This was the thing, he said, want to share the church with the Tartan Army. Persuaded the church to free him up, and he would spend ages on internet chat rooms. I mean, my colleagues thought this was a nonsense, like, what I'm doing in these chat rooms. He would chat to the Tartan Army about the love of Jesus. I mean, I guess if you're used to following the Tartan Army, then, you know, a bit of good news from time to time wasn't going to do you any harm. But that was his thing. Alan would do this, but he's obsessed. He's obsessed with sharing the gospel with people who aren't particularly churchy. And he's just planted a church in Rochese, and about 50 to 60 people are coming to it. In Rochese, the church had six people for years and years and years who came to it. It's famously the smallest church in Glasgow Presbytery. But it's now got 50 or 60 people coming to it. Anyway, Alan was telling me a story yesterday of how he had been to Bray Head, which is a big shopping centre, with his other church, which is in White Inch on the west side of Glasgow. And Bray Head's a big shopping centre just on the border with Paisley. And they had come up with a deal where they were going to go to Bray Head, to the food court, and they were just going to put a sign up saying who would like some encouragement. So that's the church we're going to do. So they'd arranged, they'd got permission from Bray Head, and Bray Head had even gone further, and they put signs up all around the middle of Bray Head, said, go to the food court if you want some encouragement. So I was terrified. He's at this table, the chair, and they've got some signs up, so come here for encouragement. I don't know if it said the church or anything, Alan's terrified, and he's used to this stuff. I mean, I'd be shaking. But he's terrified, and a queue starts to form of folk who would like some encouragement. He says, oh my goodness, we better deliver here. And at the front of the queue are two lads in shell suits, out like someone out of Chewing the Fat, and they're in their late teens, and they're just messing around, and they're a complete rip here, and they're going to make a mockery of these Christians. And the two guys come and they sit down, and Alan's there, and he says, right, boys, would you like some encouragement? Aye, mister, aye, you fancy a bit of that? Great one, nice one, Reverend. So he says, and Alan said, the word that came into my head, just looking at these guys, was apprentice. So he just turns to them and he says, I'm to encourage you about apprenticeships. And then I just had this thing come over me. And I said, I think I'll say to the guy, and don't worry about what anybody else is saying, just take the apprenticeship. I think that's what God's saying to you. The guy says, how do you know me? And he's looking around, like, for cameras and stuff. And he's thinking, nah. It's just like, you know, these days it's Michael McIntyre. He says, how do you know me? He says, you've been talking to my dad. I was like, no, I've never met you in my life before. I'm just giving you some encouragement. He says, me and my dad have been arguing for the last 6 months about me taking an apprenticeship. He says, and my dad wants me to go and work in our business, but I want to get an apprenticeship at a company down the road, and I really want to do it, and my dad keeps telling me I need to go in the business. And Alan says, well, I think there's a word from the Lord to you. I think you need to become an apprentice, and maybe God is actually telling you that in this occasion your dad's wrong. And he's like, whoa. Like his mates, like, whoa, you know. And they kind of walk off kind of stunned. And Alan says, I can go home now. He says, what kind of God is that? That decides on a Saturday afternoon in Bray Head, he thinks to himself, I know what we'll do the day. He says to one of the angels, you know, like a few thousand years ago, it was that stuff with the fish. I tell you what, we'll go down to Bray Head, and I need to tell that boy to get him to an apprenticeship. And we'll use the fact that he loves taking the mic, and we'll use the fact that he wants to show off to his mates, and we'll use the fact that he thinks religion's a whole load of nonsense, and we're going to use all that, and we're going to get him on a chair, and we're going to tell him to go on an apprenticeship. What kind of God's that? And yet that's the God of this story. who takes a bunch of 16 and 17 year old lads, takes them fishing, fills their nets with fish, and then says, now you're going to follow me. And a completely different kind of apprenticeship with a rabbi who's going to use them to found a faith that's going to transform the whole world. What kind of God does that? And the good news of the gospel is he's still doing it. There's no human being for whom God does not do this, especially not we who are called. Elizabeth Gilbert, who wrote a book called Eat, Pray, Love, tells the story of a friend of hers who's a researcher into women's advancement in careers. And this researcher is particularly interested in women who have risen across the world to positions of management and of influence, particularly in cultures where that would not normally be expected. So this researcher has gone around the whole world. And she sits with these folk, and like a researcher, she takes her dictaphone out and she records what they say, and she begins to ask them, you know, how did you get to the position of influence that you're in now? And the researcher says, the interviews always start with roughly the same stuff. Folks say, oh, to succeed in business, you have to work twice as hard as any man. Oh, kind of laugh. And then you have to form networks and you have to read all the latest management books. And these women would say all these things and the women would be recorded. But because she's quite a good researcher, she kind of gets the feeling these women are not telling you the whole story here. And she kept asking them, well, but is that all? And I said, well, I suppose, you know, I went to night classes. Oh, but is that all? Well, I suppose I decided that I wasn't going to get married for a few years until I got a career. Yeah, but is that all? And eventually the woman, and she said this happened in nearly every interview she ever did. The woman said, okay, I'll tell you what it was. But you have to switch that recording off because this is embarrassing. And the woman's like, okay. She says, but you mustn't tell anyone this. The reason that I went into the career that I did was because a voice told me. A voice told me. And this was showing up in every interview, that people had a sense of a call. Now, I'm listening to this story as a Christian minister, and going, these people are not churchgoers. How can this be true? These people possibly belong to other religions. What's that about? These people are not followers of Jesus. No way. What kind of picture is it for me that says all around the world, God is saying to disempowered young girls, and I would like you to go into a career in which you'll flourish in your talents. That God all around the world, in all different places, God, who could be out there in Jupiter, is going to random women and girls and people about whom nothing is expected of them and putting voices in their head and said, you're going to be something. You're going to be someone. But that is God. And that is God to each one of you and to each one of us. God is still calling us. No matter if we are young or if we are old, you think you're too old to be called by God, have a read of the scriptures. You know, Sarah was 90 when she gave birth to Abraham. I'm not suggesting, by the way. But, yeah, there's a few of you here, thank you. But, you know, God is calling people in the most unlikely of settings to say, you are going to do a thing for me and with me, which is going to be part of the transformation of the world. And nobody is exempted from that. No matter how many times they've been written off, no matter the expectations, no matter they think, I am a sinful man, I am a sinful woman, God says, no. This is a word for you. So I ask you this morning, where are you in this story? Where does it speak to you? Are you in the crowd, straining to hear this thing that's called the word of God, the expressiveness of God? Are you the fisherman casually listening? The one who's been written off? The one who's frustrated because they've spent a whole night out and they haven't caught a thing? Are you like the fisherman dipping his nets into the water thinking, this guy, Jesus, he doesn't know what he's talking about, but we'll humour him? Are you the one pulling on the nets, thinking, whoa, something is going on here? Are you the one on the deck of the boat, bowing down, saying, away from me, I'm a sinful man? Are you the one who hears a word from Jesus? Do not be afraid. I will make you a fisher of men. Are you the one who's letting go of the nets and the encumbrances and the securities and the expectations and saying, yes, I will follow him? Which one are you?